This is an interview with Clarence Birbaum for the Veterans History Project, September 5th, 2007, conducted by Jesse Philippi in Studio X Campbell Hall at WILL TV, Urbana, Illinois. Okay. First question. Were you aware of the war that was already going on overseas before Pearl Harbor was
attacked? Yes, very much so. From when Hitler first started into Europe, yeah.
Okay.
We had a lot of information from that, yeah.
Okay. And how was that? Was it usually the news or?
Oh, it was radio news. Of course, didn't have any television that day. The radio covered things quite well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard the problems they had over there. And, of course, I think the president said, we don't want to get mixed up over there. We want to leave it to them, you know.
Right.
Until Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
Yeah, I very much remember Pearl Harbor.
Okay. Do you remember what you were doing when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was out on the farm. I had gotten out of high school, and I worked for Dad for 1 year, a summer, and then I got a chance to work in radio at Robeson's. And I worked for a man there for 2 years repairing radios. And then I was called to the service and drafted in February of 42.
Okay. What do you remember? What was the general feeling of, like, among, you know, the people you knew, the town, in terms of what was the general feeling of whether or not America should even get involved in?
Well, just like there are people today that are saying we should get out of Iraq,
mm-hmm.
there were people were saying, no, we shouldn't be there. And, you know, before Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when Pearl Harbor was hit, a lot of ideas changed. Yeah.
Mm, yeah.
Then most of the country got behind the effort.
Okay. When did you go into the service?
February the 11th, 1942.
Okay.
I was drafted in the fall, and I was working for Kenneth Lappin and Robeson's, and my dad had a man working for him, and he was drafted, and so my dad needed some help for the fall work, and mm-hmm. so he went to the draft board and got me off until January 1st.
Okay.
And of course then they turned him down then, so I was called on February 11th.
Okay. And so, okay, so how old were you at the time?
I was 22.
22. And you were drafted into the infantry,
yeah.
The 100th Infantry? And
well, that was a long time later.
Oh, okay.
When I was first drafted, I went to Camp Grant to be inducted. And then they shipped me along with a whole bunch of other people, a group of us, went down to Fort Knox to the the Armored Basic Training, the Basic Training for Armored Force.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 2 months there, and then they shipped us to Pine Camp, New York, to the 4th Armored Division.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a tank. And all that year. Then I got a chance that fall to go to a radio school in Fort Knox. And I had 3.5 months there. And then they, by that time, the 4th Armored was in the desert in California.
Mm.
And I went, so then we got off of a nice train into a very bad desert. It was a different life.
So how was it?
Well, it was in January. It was from January through April.
Okay.
And in January it wasn't too bad. It was, you know, 70 or 80 in the desert, but it gets cold as the dickens at night. And of course the snakes and the whole thing, you know.
Right.
But then we would go out in the tanks, and I said in my documentary that we went up and down those hills in the desert there in California an awful lot. And I was in there until, I think it's about March, I got a chance to go to the Division Signal Company, because I had been in radio, and I said, I want to get something about radio. And so I was in the signal company.
Okay.
Then. And then we moved, the whole division moved to Camp Bowie, Texas. And we were there a couple of months. And I had heard that the Air Force, Army Air Force at that time, was looking for airmen, pilots, co-pilots, and navigators, so forth. And so I applied, and luckily got to the Air Force Cadets in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, and had 5 months of college. And that's where every week they would bring in another class, you know. And we graduated on a Friday, and that was in the spring. And on Saturday, the company commander, I guess they'd call him the squadron commander there, called us all together and said, guess what? We're closing the school, and you're either going back to your outfit or you're going to the infantry. That's how I ended up in the 100th Infantry Division.
Okay.
Before we went overseas.
So you said you were working for a radio
repair.
Oh, you were doing radio repair for.
Yeah, and this is a man had a little shop in Robeson's. At that time, it was a Robeson's department store, and he was in the basement. And I went down and asked him, I said, all I know is farming, and I'd like to know some more about radio. And so Slim looked and says, well, I can't afford to hire you. I said, well, I'll work for nothing. So I did that. I worked for a week for nothing. And finally, then he said, well, you can't afford to come in here for nothing. So he gave me $5 a week. And that was my pay for about a year, and then he raised it to $7.50, and then finally, before I quit there, I was making $10 a week.
Wow! And so you were working there while you were in the Army?
No. This is before the Army.
Okay. I
had gotten out of school. I graduated in 1938.
Okay.
From Champaign High, and so I decided I wanted to do something else, mm-hmm. And Slim offered me the job. And so I did radio repair for 2 years and learned a lot about the basics of radio.
Okay.
And so, and it was I'm glad I did, because as I've said to my wife and some other people, probably that saved my life.
Really?
Because by just talking about radio, I was able to get into the radio repair overseas.
Oh, okay.
And I could tell some stories about that too, but that's another story. But okay. I was able to leave my my battalion and go to the regimental area. They were collecting all the radio repairmen and putting them in one unit in the regimental headquarters. And that's where we did radio repair. We were anywhere from a mile to 2 or 3 miles behind the lines.
Okay. And
usually with the big guns, the 105s, they were shooting all the time.
Okay.
So that's how I got through there. And then after the war, we occupied from May until January 2nd when I got on the boat to come home.
Okay.
But, yeah, that was kind of, that's a very quick story of my Army career.
Okay. Let's see. So, you've probably said this somewhat, what were the, like, dates that you served from when you started and ended in the Army?
When I started in the Army?
Yeah.
Well, of course,
that is
when you first get in the Army, the first thing you find out is do what you're told.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see an officer salute, those are the things you learn real quick. And so I was very careful. Whatever they said to do, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Fort Knox, and we had our 2 months of basic training.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, my first couple of months, I was paid an entire sum of $21 a month, minus my laundry and minus my insurance, which we got about $17 a month. And then they raised it up, and we got $50 a month. That was something. And then I made $50 a month all the time until I went overseas, and I got overseas pay. It was $78. I got to be a first class, a PFC,
okay.
And that's as far as I ever got.
When was it again that you were released from the Army, when you, the end of the war and that?
Oh, at the end of the war?
Yeah, you know, like when you got home and
well,
everything.
Well, that was, yeah. When I got home, I helped my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was farming by that time. And I helped them. And then I repaired radios. And I wired houses and so forth. In 1946,
okay,
I wired 46. Houses. And that just picked up. I just said I'll have to get some time off.
Okay.
And then in January of 47, I went to American Television in Chicago, a technical school.
Mm-hmm.
I was there until through April of 48. And at that time, all engineers in a broadcast service had to have a first class ticket. And so I got my first class ticket, and when I was up in Chicago in the school, and I came down and applied for a job at a station called WKID. It was in Urbana off of Philo Road, and I was there for 2 years. The first year and a half, I was an engineer, and then there was some engineer quit and a few other people, and so I got to be chief engineer. I really was not too well acquainted with it all, but I mm-hmm. was a chief engineer for 6 months. Then I went to WILL and had a chance to get in there in the recording service.
Okay.
Then I went to television and came back as assistant chief engineer, or I was assistant chief in over there.
Okay.
And I was there for 29 years. It was a good experience. I certainly didn't care for the Army, and I took a lot of movies when I was in the service. My wife says, "How did you ever get by with a thing like that?" I took pictures of us marching and so forth, and but I made a documentary, of my Army career, and my sister-in-law saw it, and afterwards she was at our house. She said, "Why was it so depressing?" I said, "Because that's what it was. I was depressed for 4 years, but it kind of gave a history of my Army career."
Okay. Where did you serve?
How's that?
Where did you serve again?
Oh, I served in the ATO, in European Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we hit the battle lines in the Vosges Mountains. That was in the late fall. Well, we got over there in November, and we hit the line around after that. And a sidelight to this story, or this my Army career, from what I heard, the Vosges Mountains had never been conquered in all of military history. And we were the first ones that went through, the division, I certainly was behind the lines, you know, on some of that. And they captured the citadel at Biche, France.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our moniker on the 100th Division. We call it the Loyal Sons of Biche.
Okay.
And we've always said, we always enjoy saying that. Yeah, so then they finally broke through the Maginot Line, which, tremendous fortifications, even yet.
Hmm.
And then we went into Germany, went through Mannheim, we went to Heilbronn, and then they made another stand there and killed a lot of the fellas. And finally, the division conquered, or they got Heilbronn, and we were circling Stuttgart when the war ended. We were around about halfway, and our division was. When the war ended in May, what was it, the 8th or 9th, something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe the 10th. I still can't remember for sure. It's around that.
Yeah.
Then we were in occupation from there on. We were in a little town called Leonberg, and then we moved into Stuttgart in Bad Cannstatt, which is a suburb of Stuttgart.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were very fortunate then. Of course, it was still, the war was on over in Europe, over in Asia, mm-hmm. and we were getting ready. They were still training us to go over there,
mm-hmm.
and then Japan surrendered. So then I got a couple of very good leaves, one to the Riviera, which I never could have afforded. It's beautiful. I spent a week there, and then spent a week in London. So we were very lucky. Once the wars ended, the services were very congenial with us. So I did get to see a lot of area over there at that time.
That's good. Okay. I'm just curious. Did mm-hmm. Were you involved in any of, freeing any concentration camps or any of that?
After the war, when we were in the first part of the occupation,
mm-hmm.
I had a very good friend, Eli, as he was, he was Jewish. And we went around and we saw some of the concentration camps from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
How must have been bad, you know. And I was in, as I say, in Bad Cannstatt for a while. Then I was transferred to Kirchheim Unter Teck, which is a town about halfway between Stuttgart and, we was around Ulm. And then it was on, we went to, I can't say the name now. Oh, I have to stop and think. what is it? Stuttgart, Ulm, and Munich. Munich.
Okay.
And one Sunday, and this was after the war had ended, and I decided I'm going to get out of here today. So I put a K-ration in my pocket and went out on the Autobahn and started thumbing away on my ride. And an officer and two soldiers were in a Jeep, and they saw, "Where are you going, soldier?" I said, "I'm going down on your ways." And they says, "We're going to Munich, so but we'll stop in at Dachau." And that was a real experience. It was only a short time after it had been cleaned up. I mean, weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see the crematories and where their people were hung, and I got pictures of all this. And that was revealing, mm-hmm. Yes. I understand from my brother-in-law, who has been over there recently to see, it's left about the same. It has never been changed. But, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that was quite depressing, and that was quite a Sunday outing.
Yeah.
And then I did get to Munich, and I saw the Bergerbaukeller and that sort of thing, and then I got home. And that was quite a Sunday out. Yes, that's the only thing that I can really say that I saw pretty much firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about the chaos of the war. Kind of, how did that affect you?
I had some experiences. We had some, I had some rough times.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home and I didn't want to talk about it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Even after I got married, the wife said at times that I would roll around in bed and have dreams. It didn't affect me nearly as much as a lot of the fellas that had mm-hmm. it much worse than I had.
Yeah.
But yes, it is a traumatic experience.
Okay. Were there times in the war where, like, I don't know, there was so much confusion going on, or like, did you know where you were most of the time, like where the enemy was, where your objective was, and
truly
things like that?
I didn't know where I was. We get in the truck and the little trailer that we'd fix up, and we'd move to another place, and I knew this Petit Redershing, Gross Redershing, mm-hmm. in those old towns.
Right.
I wouldn't know where they were today. My brother-in-law and his wife went over and looked at, found those places, and he told me the stories more of where, you know, what they are today. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's altogether different now than it was then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you said that you have stories about your experiences with, doing radio repair for the
army. Yeah, that is another sidelight of it. We did get radios, you know, from the front lines, and mm-hmm. it was just a wet, messy year. You know, it's so just terrible. The snow and wet and all that, and of course, the guys you'd have these radios, and they'd get them all wet, and so we'd have a lot of work to clean them out and dry them out, and of course, there's some of them that something was blowing out, and we had to do some repairing of them. And yeah, we're always getting those things in. And our communication, the little hand radios they had in those days, people today wouldn't even recognize them. And they weren't much good. They'd go maybe a mile, if you're lucky, you know.
Okay.
And the ones that, the radios that would go longer, they were a big pack. It was a big pack with a battery, I would say would be, probably 8 or 10 pounds just for the battery mm-hmm. that was went with the radio. And of course, an officer would try to have a radio man with them when they could mm-hmm. to communicate with others. But a lot of it was, in my opinion, for what I'd get from some of the fellas, it was a lot of confusion and maybe even chaos at times. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we got a lot of radios to repair like that. Yeah.
Okay. And so you said that you were usually like further back with the radios.
Yeah, we usually were about a mile behind the lines, maybe 2 miles.
Yeah.
We after all, it was there were definitely lines at that time. Mm-hmm. You knew where the Germans were.
Right.
You knew where the Americans were, and once in a while we'd have somebody, a German, kind of wander up in our area, and he'd find out that he was in the wrong area and scramble, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And our guys would, one of our linemen, and we were talking about this years later, up in Michigan, and he said that they were doing a lot of wiring. They ran a lot of wire in those days. It was, mm-hmm. That's their communication. And he said they were told to go to one house and put up a telephone. It was at night, and it was dark, and they had to feel their way practically get through. In the next house, they didn't know it, but they were all Germans. So it was that close in the house, when they were in these small towns.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some funny stories about that, about the things they would do, and that they'd see somebody and you just fall down and be quiet.
Wow.
Yeah, sort of thing. Yeah, yeah, there's those those stories. It's interesting to hear some of them. I didn't get into that. I was usually just far enough back that
mm-hmm.
I was lucky on that part.
Right. And that was just when they were running communication lines.
Yes, yeah, when they try to run communication lines.
Hmm.
And of course, when the battle would move, then the guys would go out and they take the jeeps and so forth, or take a reel or something and try to reel up all the wire they could reel, so they could use it the next time. Because it was mainly wire communication. Radio was just not that reliable.
Mm-hmm.
In certain cases it was. And of course, back farther, where they had the more powerful radios, that was much more reliable mm-hmm. than we had on the front lines.
Okay. So that was Morse code, or those Morse code, or other kinds of
code. We learned Morse code, but they weren't using much Morse code then. It was just voice.
Oh, it was voice over wire.
Mostly voice,
okay,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah, when I was in school in Fort Knox,
mm-hmm.
we had to go through learn Morse code.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. There were certain places, I think the Navy and different places, they used Morse code different ways. And of course, it was all coded, and people wouldn't catch what it was anyhow.
During the war, what did you believe, or did you have any beliefs about what was at stake in the war? Specifically.
Well, I think my feeling was just about what all the soldiers were.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get this thing over with and go home.
Yeah.
But we knew, and I didn't know, actually I'll put it this way, I didn't know how bad the situation was in Germany mm-hmm. with the Jewish population until after the war when I went through Dachau.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories that some of those people, that those people told, there was one fellow that could speak just fairly good English, and he told some stories that, well, I would hate to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know.
Yeah.
So we didn't realize how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember one point, one place, one little town in France when we were in that winter we were there. And when one of the non-coms came to me and said, Bierbaum, you want to see what the Germans have done to some of the people? And I thought about it a little bit, and I said, no. Because it was in a building there, and he had seen it, and he showed mm-hmm. what some of the people went through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bad enough.
So you just wanted to mainly get out of there?
A lot of it I just wanted to forget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, do you have any strong beliefs about what you were fighting for, or like what?
Yeah, we're fighting to keep Hitler from going any farther.
Okay.
Because, of course, he had the alliance with Italy and Japan. And why did Japan strike Pearl Harbor? And there was an alliance there. They all wanted to take over the United States, and they wanted to take a piece of it. And Hitler was going to take, he'd taken France, mm-hmm. and he wanted to take England. And we mm-hmm. know how bad that was, and how the English were treated before we got into it.
Yeah.
And so yes, we felt that it was worthwhile to do what we needed to do.
Mm-hmm. And did that view of the war change at all though? Did that change at all when you got overseas and started fighting, or any time?
There's not much that we didn't. I don't think any of us thought that way.
Okay.
We were in the service. We had a job to do, and mm-hmm. we did it. You know.
And so you just realized more once you finally got to the concentration camps.
Yeah.
And,
I was just saying the concentration camp. Some of that we didn't realize that till after when we were in occupation. Mm-hmm. We saw those things.
Yeah.
And I only saw Dachau. I understand the other ones were, the other concentration camps were just as bad or worse.
Yeah. You've kind of already answered this, but how did you feel about the specific enemies that you were fighting that at certain times? I don't know if you were ever fighting the Italians, but
I didn't get into that.
Okay.
I know some people that did they started in Africa and they came up through Sicily and mm-hmm. Italy and all that, and some of them had it pretty rough for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't. All we faced were the Germans,
mm-hmm.
and they got to be where some of them were. The officers were all really fanatic. They just pushed the soldiers into our lines.
Okay,
that's what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
The little we would hear. You know.
And did you kind of feel that their soldiers weren't as fanatic, or were just
our soldiers?
The enemy soldiers.
The German soldiers, I think. Well, a lot of them got killed.
Right.
You know, they just. But I don't know. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
We met a few of the German soldiers after the war, during occupation,
mm-hmm.
and they were glad to have it over with.
Mm-hmm.
And they were happy that they were back home and could do their thing again, get mm-hmm. to an ordinary living.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when the night that my cousin picked me up to take me to the draft, to the bus.
Mm-hmm.
I told my dad, I said, I don't expect to be back. And I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fellas didn't come back. So, but I was very lucky and did.
Mm-hmm. How did that feel before you got on the bus, with the family? And
what do you do? That there's a point where this is it. I'm drafted. I can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going. I'll mm-hmm. do what I'm told, and I don't know where I'm going to go.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Many and many a night, I didn't have any idea where I would be the next day.
Yeah.
You know. Because when we left Fort Knox, we didn't know where we were going and what outfit we were going to be going in. And finally, I have some movies of us in the train, found out that we were going east.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally we went up to northern New York State Watertown and Pine Camp. And then we found out we were going to the 4th Armored Division, because mm-hmm. there was no information like that in the Second World War. Very, very tight in the news media.
Okay.
Very tight. And I, even for our soldiers, it didn't mean much of anything. We still weren't told.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the officers knew. They had more of an indication than we, but still, we just as a private and a PFC, you don't. That's just part of life,
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. What kinds of things the videos that you take, and what kinds of things do they show?
When I got overseas, I couldn't take anything of the military.
So okay.
That is one thing. See, we had, I think, five fellas and a warrant officer. And the warrant officer was right with us day and night. We were all together.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, one thing you don't take, Bear Bomb, is the guns or anything. Like, we had pictures of, I have one of one little town at that time, how they washed their clothes. They had there was a tank in the middle of town, and people would bring their clothes and they'd dump it in the water and they'd scrub them off, and that's how they wash clothes. I have pictures of that.
Mm-hmm.
And people walking around, trying to get food,
mm-hmm.
so they can eat, so forth. And I do have some pictures of like the half tracks and going down the road. And I do have one picture, one movie of us going over the pontoon bridge at Mannheim, and we were in a smoke screen. It isn't very good, but it does. We can see that it's a, then we have pardon me. We have pictures of. I have some pictures of the bridges that were knocked out, and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And foxholes. If you would care to see it, I'd be glad to show it to you. It's not very good, but I, you know, lend you a copy. Oh, excuse me. I gotta have some water.
That's a good idea.
I've been talking a lot. I'm bringing back a lot of memories that I haven't thought of for years.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it was an experience, and it's been a long, long time ago.
Any particular good memories about the wartime experience?
Yes. Yeah, when I was in the desert, I got a 3-day pass to Los Angeles. Okay. No, it's more than that. And it was several days pass. Yeah, we got weekend pass.
I can hear your shoes. Your squeaky shoes. Can you set your feet flat for me? I can hear your shoes squeaking. Sorry.
Do it like that?
Yeah.
When I was, we got to L.A., and I heard someone say that if you want to see a movie studio, why sign up here? And so I signed up, and then they said you meet at a certain door the next morning. Well, it was 7:00, and I think about 6:00 I was there. I was right in front of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, that day, they only took 7 of us to a place called Monogram Studios.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I had my movie camera, and I took some pictures of them when they were, you know, making movies. And, of course, I took it while they were doing rehearsals and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the cameraman was so wonderful. He let me set up on the camera dolly and take pictures doing that, and I've got several minutes of and the people that were there, the talent that was there at that time, and and that was quite an experience, because I liked movies at that time, you know, and I thought, well, gee, I'd get all the kid, and that's part of what's in the documentary. I had to show some of that, you know.
That's good.
So yes, that was an interesting day.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to go around LA and see the beach and a few things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a good experience. And as I said, when overseas, after the war, when I got to go to the Riviera, the one city there along the Mediterranean, there's one of the hotels is called the Hermitage.
Okay.
Hermitage, but it's the Hermitage of the French, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But we were treated like just royally. I mean, it was, you know, you come to the door and then they would seat you and all that stuff for all your meals.
Mm-hmm.
that was quite an experience. And I spent a week in the Riviera,
mm-hmm.
and that was of course after the war, and the officers could be there in that town, but you don't salute officers in that town. you could get by, but we couldn't go to their town, you know, sort of thing. And it was quite an experience there. And of course, I went to London, mm-hmm. and I got to see the sights of London. I just stayed in London for actually was 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
An experience that I had, quite interesting. I was in London. I was walking down the street, and I looked up, and there was my first cousin. Jack Bez. And he was an officer. And I said, Jack! And then I backed up and I saluted. But he and I got together then, and he had married a girl from London. Mm-hmm. And I spent the day with him and his wife and the family, and that was quite an experience. I mean, you know, to walk through London and not even realize that you knew anyone, and mm-hmm. here was my first cousin. That was something unusual. Yeah,
interesting.
We had some time, so I did have some good experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them after the war. But, yeah. Now those, at least I did get to see a lot of the Europe. A lot mm-hmm. of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I was favorably impressed with some of the things. Just mm-hmm. lucky that I got out the way it did.
Yes. What you talked about how some of your footage you got to see the town life in, I guess, France and Germany. And
not too well.
They washed their clothes. Oh, okay.
So we didn't see many of the, you know, it wasn't, by the time we got into the town, the people in France, mm-hmm. is a good example, they were gone. They weren't going to stay there because the war was going through there.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Germans were pushed back,
mm-hmm.
and then a few of the people would start coming back into the town. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And we got to meet a few of them. Of course, French, and I spoke very little French, and they spoke very little English, mm-hmm. but we got along on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, but they were having very hard time because they'd had several years of... of Germany,
mm-hmm.
and taking everything from them, you mm-hmm. know. So, yeah, they were just trying to exist.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. So.
It wasn't a standard, an ordinary
right.
French village that you go into.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, we're fighting through there.
Right.
Yeah.
So you saw how they were struggling then.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. We saw a lot of that where the people were just struggling to get anything, any food and so forth
mm-hmm.
to get along. Yeah.
Okay. And did you have to help them out with some aid things like that or?
We didn't. We were too far, too much of the front lines.
Oh, okay.
You know, it wasn't. Wouldn't be a part of our group. We were just hoping to get through there so we can go to the next town. You know?
So that was more where the bulk of the population was, probably.
They were. They were elsewhere. Some of them just went to the woods.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of the Vosges Mountains were a low. Mountains, but there are a lot of woods there.
Okay.
And people just went into the woods for a while.
Okay.
Until this passed.
Did you meet with? Just curious if you met with some of the French resistance against the Germans when you went through France.
No, I didn't see any of the French resistance people in our area at
mm-hmm.
all.
Okay.
Yeah. There were more of the intelligence groups in different, different areas.
Okay.
But, I didn't see them.
Okay.
At least we didn't know.
Yeah.
Maybe they were, but we didn't know.
No one in the mountains or anything?
No.
No. Okay.
But the mountains were, there were enough mountains, enough rolling hills that it was difficult country to be, to be fighting a war in.
Mm-hmm.
And of course then the eastern side of it between France and Germany was the Maginot Line, and of course the Siegfried Line was on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that the Siegfried Line did much about holding us back.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we broke through the Maginot Line, the German army was pretty much in in chaos, really, and they were running.
Mm-hmm.
Until, of course, when they went to Heilbronn, which is, 30, 40 miles farther east, and that was along the Neckar River, and they were going to hold it at that point, and, gee, a lot of guys got it there. It was just, we ran into the division and they ran into this and not knowing that they were going to hold, and it was
okay.
It was pretty rough.
So they were initially like defending the mountains and you had to fight
and
through them.
It was very hilly in that area too. Yeah.
So they had the higher ground on you.
That's it. And it was a lot of manufacturing and a lot of places those people could hide and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. See, and too, and that it was rough.
Yeah. Okay. How do you feel about the war now, in retrospect? Looking back on it, or how do you feel about the enemy?
Second World War?
Yeah, the Second World War.
Well, my feeling was it was necessary
mm-hmm.
because what the Japanese did
mm-hmm.
and how that was and how vicious that was over there, and we needed to stop it, and we need. And I feel as a they should have done what they did
mm-hmm.
because it has changed the whole global situation
mm-hmm.
of the Europe and Japan and China and all this. There's a lot of political change mm-hmm. now.
That's true. I've gone through most of my questions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you can think of?
No, I think I just opened up today.
I've
reminisced on a lot of things. I'll mm-hmm. say that.
You think we covered most of the ground? I think.
Yeah, we did, and I hope that this will turn out to be a very interesting series,
mm-hmm.
program, and so forth.
Yeah. Okay.
Will I get a copy of this to see what I?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I would like very much to have.
I'm going to do that. Yeah. Okay. So
just a VHS tape would be, like see what I did.
Yeah.
I would like that, if it could be done.
Yeah,
okay. Oh, that'd be fine.